I always feel like School Choice Week, it's like one of the rare occasions where we have an event at Reason that's mostly good news. Like we tend to hold these events that are like, the economy is a disaster, the political process is a disaster. So it's really nice to have this event where it's like everyone puts on your cute yellow scarves and we're like, School Choice is winning.
I think there was a story that's been going around Facebook today that really encapsulates kind of the spirit of school choice. And this actually is about these parents that are camping out in Shelby County, Tennessee in the freezing cold to get their kids a spot in the school of their choice. And I guess this district in Tennessee has like some kind of options program where only a certain number of kids can sign up and you have to be there in person. So they're actually camping out now for a decision that's gonna be decided on Monday. And so, like, one of the women that they interviewed, she's number 38 in line, right, to get her kid a spot in a school, and she's planning on, like, sleeping in a tent in front of the school district until Monday so she can get her kid in a school. Now, as a school choice advocate, I'm not sure that I would even work that hard for my own kid, but it's commendable, and it goes to kind of the fact that in the United States, the demand for school choice really exceeds the available spots. And even so, there's way more school choice than there was 20 years ago. And today, the Milton Friedman Foundation for Educational Choice published their annual ABCs of school choice, and they came out with some new numbers on how much school choice is really growing in the United States. And, you know, it's interesting because officially vouchers and tax credits, so vouchers you get, it's like a Pell Grant, you get an amount of money that you can pick the school of your choice, and tax credits you either get to keep your own money or you get some rich person's money or some other person's money to send your kid to school. But those programs, like 10 years ago, really Milwaukee was the only school choice program in the United States, and it had about 7,000 kids. And so today we actually have over 300,000 kids that are using either a tax credit or a voucher to send their kids to school. And there's some notable programs that I'll just read you a couple numbers. So Florida actually has the largest tax credit scholarship program in the country. And they have 60,000 kids that are using tax credits to go to the school of their choice, private school. They have almost 30,000 kids that are in a special needs scholarship program where if they have a special education designation, they can then use the amount of money that would have gone to their special education to go to any school of their choice in the state. Indiana is interesting because it has a new school choice program that now has 20,000 kids. It's only in the second year, and it's one of the only voucher programs in the country where it's not completely restricted to low-income kids, and some middle-income kids can go. Pennsylvania has 30,000 kids using tax credits. Arizona has what's called an education savings account, and that's pretty interesting because the whole per pupil amount actually works like a medical savings account where it goes into the parent's discretion into an account and they can use it not just for a school but for any kind of education expenses, and then the money rolls over. So if you don't use all of the per pupil allotment that's in your education savings account, you can apply it towards college, or maybe you don't use all the money in elementary school but you want to pick a more expensive high school education. So these education savings accounts started out, they were only for special education kids or foster care kids. And now they've expanded the program to be any low-income kids that are in failing schools. And every year they're planning on expanding the program. So education savings account, a completely new model that didn't exist a few years ago. There's 6,000 charter schools with 2.2 million kids. And people like to talk about charter schools like they're really some kind of marginal reform. But if you think about it, charter schools work exactly like voucher schools. They're open enrollment. You only get the per pupil allotment if the parents choose the schools. And there's 2.2 million kids in charter schools and 1 million kids in waiting lists. And charter schools are interesting because they politically have been more feasible because you don't have to have a statewide initiative fight with the teachers' unions over, you know, should we have a voucher program or a tax credit. They've been much more stealth because they've been able to get one charter school or three charter schools approved at a time. And then what's happened is you have cities like Los Angeles or New Orleans. New Orleans has 100% of their kids enrolled in charter schools now. They're going to become the first ever all charter school district. And their scores have really been through the roof. They used to be ranked second to last in the state of Louisiana for the test scores. And they've actually gone up, I think, 40 spots in the last 5 years. So they're, I think, 33rd or something like that in the state in terms of districts. But they went out of like 90-something districts, they went from dead last to 33rd. Their graduation rates and test scores have improved rapidly. Los Angeles has lost 200,000 kids to charter schools, and they have over 200 charter schools within the geographic area of Los Angeles. So there's places like Cleveland, Detroit, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, where the market share of charter schools and where the money follows the kids and the kids select these schools based on their, you know, parents' investigation and choice is really growing. And the teachers' unions really know that. The other notable thing about the charter school movement is it's really where there's been room for innovation. So not only is New Orleans known for giving kids choice, they've had all these kinds of interesting, you know, apps and innovations and technology to help kids in New Orleans because they're able to try, because they don't have the normal restrictions, bureaucracy, rules, and they can get around those rules. So they've called also New Orleans the kind of Silicon Valley of education in terms of experimentation. And there's a lot going on with technology in terms of blended learning and flipped classrooms. And I know Catherine's going to talk about technology a little bit and give you the details. And then the final thing that I'll say is because of all of this choice, one of the things that Katie and I have been studying is urban school districts have decided to give their own students choice and autonomy to their principals, and they've actually started having kind of market education environments within their school district where they let the money follow the child and they let the principals make decisions about the money. And Katie's going to talk a little more about that. And so I would just like to conclude with the fact that compared to 20 years ago, we have a lot more school choice. We have a lot farther to go, but lots of indicators, whether it's technology, charter schools, vouchers, the way the teachers' unions are reacting, point to a future where parents really are going to keep demanding choice. They're never going to go back. They're going to sleep in tents, but hopefully someday they won't have to. They'll be able to have choices without camping out for, you know, a weekend in the coldest weekend of the year. And on that note, Katie, you want to talk about some of the public schools' reactions to school choice?
Yeah, sure. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about a whole kind of nuanced take on school choice that is district-wide. And I think 15 school districts nationwide have actually adopted this. Some people call it school funding portability. It's also known as backpacking or weighted student formula. There's a lot of different names for this particular school finance policy, which sounds really wonky and kind of boring, but I promise it is kind of cool. So what weighted student formula is a school district sends, rather than funding schools, will fund students, and money follows a child to the school of their choice. In traditional school districts, schools are usually funded by funding like teaching positions and staff-student ratios, and there's usually a huge equity gap from school to school, depending on what the finance policy is. So this is more equitable when it funds students on a per pupil basis to a school of their choice. So school choice is a huge part of this kind of equation, along with several other kind of components that work together. One way to make weighted student formula more equitable is that districts will have a base amount for a student, and then they'll have several other weights that are tacked onto that base. So, for example, in Hartford, Connecticut, there's a base amount of money that each kid gets. And then on top of that, they'll give kids extra money for if they're an English language learner or if they're special needs, if they're gifted. And then that money follows them to the school that they choose, or their parents choose. And so going hand in hand with that, that kind of creates like a market mechanism. So schools can want to attract more students to them, and then they get to also get the money that follows them to the schools. So principals should have more autonomy over that money and to make their schools more attractive, right? Markets and, you know, demand and everything. So that's another huge component of it. So with weighted student formula, principals have a much larger piece of the budget that they have autonomy over. One finding in our weighted student formula yearbook that Lisa and I worked on was that schools that have, or school districts that have a larger portion of the budget that goes directly to principals, that principals can have, you know, full autonomy over, those school districts usually have higher proficiency rates. They increase their proficiency faster, and there's much smaller achievement gaps in those districts. Also, schools with weighted student, or districts with weighted student formula, they have autonomy. Their principals have autonomy over hiring, and usually they'll have a little bit more like wiggle room with unions and trying to negotiate school contracts and that type of thing. Another In exchange for a lot of this added autonomy that principals enjoy, there's a lot of accountability measures that school district central offices will set in place to kind of keep tabs on principals, make sure that they're really putting their best foot forward and making sure that their budget is aligned with what the students need, and also making sure that they are publishing students' like success rates and that type of thing, so that parents can also be informed which school they want to send their kid to, and they have more information. But some school districts, like Lisa was mentioning, in Louisiana, the Recovery School District, are going even further than weighted student formula. I mean, they have a complete market of fully autonomous charter schools that compete to garner students. And Louisiana is the first, or the Recovery School District was the first school district that really employed this kind of new model of redefining what a school district is. But there's actually other school districts around the United States that are also employing this kind of market mechanism, like truly market mechanism of attracting students to schools. Some of those are Tennessee. They have an achievement school district that's actually modeled after Louisiana's recovery school district. It's a smaller scale. The recovery school district has 60 charter schools and 15 charter-like schools. Tennessee's district only has 10 charters and then 6 charter-like schools. But it's still, those schools have complete autonomy over how they function, how they operate. They have, the principals have autonomy over curriculum, and the schools are funded on a per-pupil basis. Also Charlotte, North Carolina, they're working on a Project LIFT. It's Project Leadership and Investment for Transformation, where there will be 9 schools that will be fully autonomous. And then there's a few others, like Kansas City, and then one that I think is most notable is in Birmingham, Alabama. Alabama doesn't even have charter school law. And in 2013 was the first year that they actually implemented 2 choice programs. So before that, they didn't really have a whole lot to offer the kids or their, you know, or their parents. And so they actually, in Birmingham, they've actually not only has the state overall adopted 2 more choice programs, but in Birmingham, they're trying to put together legislation and get the Birmingham School Board of Education has already sent this to the state to try and create their own kind of recovery type school district where there's charter-like autonomy, although they can't have charter schools. But they're trying to implement that in a state that until 2013 really had very little choice at all. So it's, I mean, what Lisa and I have been kind of showing with all of these different school choice initiatives that, that has been pushed forward, that districts are really hearing out a lot of parents and they're understanding that the need for school choice and there's a huge demand for school choice. And it's really interesting that districts are being very innovative regardless of the status quo or regardless of the laws that they have in place in their state. They're finding new ways to really provide this that school choice to parents and their communities overall. But that'll kind of turn it over to Catherine, and she'll talk about technology in the school system.
I always feel like School Choice Week, it's like one of the rare occasions where we have an event at Reason that's mostly good news. Like we tend to hold these events that are like, the economy is a disaster, the political process is a disaster, our president is a disaster, all the alternatives to our president are disasters. So it's really nice to have this event where it's like everyone puts on your cute yellow scarves and we're like, school choice is winning. But it is, which is great news. I mean, we've had kind of a slew of statistics about successes, but even just some very, very basic numbers, like 42 states plus DC allow the creation of public charter schools, right? That is something that was just completely unthinkable, 10, 20 years ago. 21 states allow students to attend whatever school they want, regardless of their home district. Every state has magnet schools. I mean, this is huge, huge progress. 23 states plus DC have vouchers or opportunity scholarships. The list goes on and on. I just want to kind of briefly make the case for throwing into those lists, for adding to that pile, kind of online learning, blended learning, and the ways that technology are adding to school choice, to educational choice, right? Because this term school choice is super powerful, and it's made tons of headway, because everybody likes choice. See, for instance, that giant stack of Reason anthologies titled Choice. But it's not just school choice, right? It's actually educational choice. People are physically attending schools where they're getting vastly different educations from each other, or they're not attending school at all, thanks to online learning. Now, the way that you know that online learning belongs on this list is that all the same people who really hate school choice also really hate online learning, right? So, like, any of the rhetoric that you hear about charters and vouchers, about
privatization,
Right, privatizer, someone's making money off this, which like can't possibly be good because it's a very important thing, and people shouldn't make money on important things. You hear that about schools. You also hear that about online education. You hear the same thing about cream skimming, right? Well, the only reason the numbers for online education look good, if they look good, is because motivated students and parents are there, and so we should disregard any successes on that basis. Diane Ravitch is like the person to check in with on this, and she hates online learning just as much as she hates charter schools and vouchers. So you know you're onto something good there when Diane Ravitch kind of loses her mind. I think there's this kind of idea that we owe kids who have the worst lot more choice, right? I mean, you hear this always with vouchers in D.C., which is, vouchers too, but charter schools in D.C., which is very charter school rich. There's still almost no charter schools located in this neighborhood, for instance. There are a couple, but most of the charter schools are located in Anacostia, where the need is the greatest. And while that is, I think, a good thing and has helped make the case for charters, one way I think to think about online learning and how that fits into this is to just say, before what we were trying to do was give kids access to at least as good as the average, right? We were just trying to take kids out of the really, really, really shitty schools that they were stuck in because of their zip code and just give them something that's okay. And I think what online learning can do and is doing is, everybody should have access to the stuff that rich people used to have, that rich people used to be the only ones to access. And this is true in all areas of life, right? Air conditioning, right? I mean, any kind of medical care, right? Ideally, the way that markets work is that we take the special expensive thing that rich people used to get, and pretty soon everybody gets it at a reasonable price. And, when you think about something like probably the biggest name in online learning, which is Khan Academy, which everyone has heard of, it's a private tutor. It's a good private tutor. And that is something that really matters. I, for instance, in high school, was a terrible private tutor. My school had this nice volunteer program, and the kids in the AP classes were supposed to help tutor the kids who needed extra help. And I am sure that I set back this poor woman in her French lessons probably like 2 or 3 years. Just like I made up answers when I didn't know them, and it was just a complete disaster. And I think that's something that's worth noting, right? That one of the things that online learning and video lessons can do is they can bring the best lesson to everyone. The best doesn't have to be an exclusive commodity anymore. And when you think about Khan, it's 52 employees, right? and they've administered 350 million online lessons. They have 10 million unique users every month. All of those people are getting basically the best four-minute tutorial about how to add fractions that you could possibly get. And that doesn't always show up in the debates about school choice. That phenomenon doesn't always show up when we're trying to capture, you know, well, how can we help kids in Louisiana? How can we help kids in New Orleans who were at the very bottom of the pile? You know, one answer is innovation in charters and just letting them physically move around from building to building and let, you know, entrepreneurs open new schools. But it may also be that, you know, the sort of state lines and the city lines and the district lines are becoming just as irrelevant as the, you know, school boundaries have already become. And I think that would be a truly awesome development. And then I guess just really quickly, I would tack on to this the fact that, you know, technology is making charters work better. And that's something that's easy to overlook. Charters have to be leaner and meaner. Charters are doing, you know, they have this set amount of money per kid or however it is that the different schools, you know, the different states do the formula, but they don't have lots of benefits like physical plant. They don't have lots of benefits like maintenance that's paid for by a separate budget item. That means you have to figure out a way to teach kids more for less money. And online learning is a huge way to do that. Blended learning, like in Rocket Ship Academy, like in the KIPP Empower Schools in Los Angeles, which I know Lisa has done some work with. You know, these are places where they had their budgets cut, and they said, we are going to figure out how to put, you know, 10 kids in front of computers and get more out of those kids than the traditional public schools are able to do. You know, I think that the idea that school choice is at least in part about escape. It's just about getting away from the worst. And we all know that we use our computers for escapism, right? We dive in there and we go to different worlds and we learn about stuff that we otherwise wouldn't have access to, and we meet people who we otherwise couldn't meet. And I think, you know, the idea that we should send kids to buildings, even better buildings, even, you know, charter school buildings that are not dangerous or that are not depressing, and still ask them to be offline for 6 hours a day, is kind of going about it all wrong. And I think charters are bringing, and school choice is bringing, more technology into the classrooms, and that can only be to the good.